Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jed Kolko, Policy Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, and your moderator for tonight's program. It's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Barbara Desore. Barbara Desore is president of Bank of America Home Loans and is a member of the company's executive management team. She leads a business that accounts for nearly one in every five mortgages originated in the U.S. Desore joined the bank in 1977. She was named Chief Technology and Operations Officer in 2005 and assumed her current role in 2008. She received a bachelor's degree in mathematics from Mount Holyoke College and an MBA from the University of California at Berkeley. In 2010, Desore was recognized by Fortune magazine as one of the 50 most powerful women in business and by U.S. Bankers' annual list of the 25 most powerful women in banking. In 2009, she was recognized by Forbes as one of the 100 most powerful women in the world. That's the world, the whole world. In 2007, she was named Business Leader of the Year by the UC Berkeley Haas School of Business. She serves on the Advisory Council of Berkeley's Haas School and is a board member of the Anderson School of Management at UCLA. Please join me in welcoming Barbara Desore.
Thank you. Thanks, Jed, for that introduction, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club of California for having me here tonight to talk about our economy, its recovery, and obviously the very critical role that housing plays in that journey of recovery. Recently, I was struck. I had the opportunity to visit Time magazine offices in New York on several occasions, and I've been struck by some of the cover pages of Time magazines. And there's one that I didn't see there, but I did see one that read, quote, high anxiety. Banks and insurance firms are tottering beneath huge portfolios of bad real estate mortgages, end quote. Sound familiar, but that cover story wasn't recent. It was from October 1990. Many of us lived through that cycle more than 20 years ago. And it's a reminder that we have weathered and we have overcome cycles like this before. I firmly believe that we will overcome this cycle as well. I believe this because I know our industry, I know my company, Bank of America, and I know that collectively we're committed to finding the way to do business that will strengthen our financial system for the future. Now, we've learned a lot of lessons through this cycle and the crisis. We've taken them to heart, as you'll hear me explain. We're committed to being a part of the solution. And I want to share with you what Bank of America is doing to make sure that that happens. My comments are going to focus on these efforts and center around three particular focus areas. First, the economy will recover, and Bank of America takes seriously our responsibility to help support that recovery. Second, consumer needs have changed, and they've changed fairly dramatically. And we at Bank of America have changed to meet those needs and drive solutions that increasingly reflect transparency and fairness. And finally, Bank of America is helping to lead a housing market transformation that's built on responsible lending and sustainable home ownership. Now, let's start with the economy. And timing is everything, right, relative to today and the volatility that the markets reflected today. But as you all know, depending on the day, the picture remains very mixed. Though our economy is growing, it's doing so much more slowly than we would have expected at this point. We were looking recently at forecasts in the company that we've done, and it seems that that rate increase that we've been expected has gotten pushed out 18 months since we started planning for last year, financial plan for 2011, and it's being pushed out farther again as we speak. The repercussions of the greatest downturn since the Great Depression are still being felt in our communities. And again, we only need to look at today's market performance to understand the uncertainty that's driving this volatility. We know that many Americans had a significant portion of their wealth tied up in their home. And from the peak of the cycle in late 2006, the recession wiped out more than $6 trillion of that home equity. It also led to a situation where one out of every four homeowners today owe more on their mortgage debt than their house is worth. And we know that those homeowners are concentrated in markets that experienced the most rapid increases during the boom part of the cycle of home prices. So those consumers' decline in wealth, coupled with sustained unemployment, continue to impact consumer spending, the greater economy, and families who are struggling to stay in their homes. Now, despite these adversities, which are significant, I have personally observed and experienced through listening to lots of Bank of America's customers the resilience of Americans and the American consumer. Now, I'm often asked, when will the housing market return to normal? It won't happen overnight. By our analysis, it's going to take several more years to clear the excess supply that exists, and I'll talk about that more. And that view is very highly dependent on the healing of the economy and, most importantly, the creation of jobs. And again, it's a very local story. In a normal market, typical inventory of housing runs about a 5-month supply. Currently, there's about a 9-month supply, and again, it varies from market to market. And depending on who you read, with the seriously delinquent customers yet to move through to liquidation or alternative solutions, there could be a 17-month housing supply. Within those supply numbers, as I said, there's a great deal of variability depending on the market. And a lot of that is driven by the foreclosure practices in a state. For example, in California, the average number of days to a foreclosure sale is 150. And in a state like Florida, it's 540. So the pace to recovery is very different. Now, there's good news. Early stage delinquencies and delinquencies overall in mortgages are declining. And we've seen that for a number of months running. And as the economy hopefully continues to improve, housing demand will improve as well. And in terms of home prices, our view is consistent with most current expectations. We expect prices to decline about another 3% through the end of this year, and really not until the end of 2012 start to see any kind of increase on a national basis that would be very modest. But remember, an additional 3% decline off of already a national average of 33% decline is at the margin pretty small. Now, you are in a place where we're starting to experience the other side of that. San Francisco, Los Angeles, starting to experience in the home price index increases in prices again. So on the whole, we believe that the very worst, 33% decline versus 3% decline, is over, but it's going to take quite a while to absorb that inventory and for housing to rebound. But in the midst of these ongoing economic challenges, our company's taken a hard look at how we can best fulfill our responsibilities to customers. Through the crisis and the recovery, as I said earlier, we've seen customers' needs evolve, and we want to be there evolving to meet those most current needs. We've looked hard at how to best help customers with their finances and provide protections to the extent that we can from unexpected hardship. We've taken actions in response to what customers have said is important. We're making progress and helping contribute to the recovery as a result, and we'll continue to evolve. First, we continue through this cycle to lend actively at Bank of America. In the midst of the crisis, we committed to a 10-year goal to make $1.5 trillion of community development dollars available to our communities, which equals about $600 million in loans made each day. Since 2009, we've extended $1.7 trillion of credit, $800 billion of that being in home loans, mortgages and home equity loans. Now, at the height of the housing bubble, the residential mortgage market in 2006 was $4 trillion. The forecast for this year is just north of $1 trillion. So a significant decline, but still a lot of opportunity. And regardless of the size of the opportunity, we remain committed to take care of customers' and consumers' needs for their home loan lending products. Through the cycle, we've stayed there. When the government was frequently viewed as the only source of liquidity, we've used the strength of our balance sheet to continue to make jumbo loans available for our clients and our customers. And in markets like California, that's been extremely important. We stayed there for our wholesale customers in making warehouse loans available so that they could continue to fund mortgage production as well. And we've strived to continue to attempt to innovate for our customers. Bank of America significantly strengthened our balance sheet over the last couple of years. We've been in discussions, a lot of discussions lately, and I would be surprised if there weren't a question about that, of is the capital that banks have or Bank of America have adequate, particularly as we face the upcoming Basel III requirements that will go into effect through 2019. Now, as a result of the efforts that we've made to improve, despite the fact that in an attempt to get some of our legacy mortgage issues behind us, we took the significant loss of earnings, the loss that we incurred this last quarter, we've still maintained over an 8% Tier 1 common equity ratio. I want to mention something that seems like ancient history from some perspective, but isn't always widely understood, and that is we repaid all of the TARP money that the government made available to this. And as I said, I point this out because as I listen to customers talk to customers, that's frequently held that there should be a quid pro quo. You still have the money from the government, for which Bank of America is very grateful that the government made that available to help avoid what could have been an even worse economic outcome. But we still don't have TARP money outstanding. We repaid it. We repaid it with interest. And as you've read most recently in Fortune, doing an accounting, the Treasury will end up with repayment and turning a profit for the taxpayers as a result. And finally, as I said, we've worked to really focus on transparency and fairness for consumers. To this end, we eliminated overdraft fees on all debit card purchases, and we continue to remain an exception in the marketplace to that end. And unlike many of our competitors, we froze interest rates on credit cards when it was clear the direction that the government was going in advance of the CARD Act taking effect. We also created, starting in mortgage, an industry-leading clarity commitment. We've done it in mortgage, and we've done it in credit card and on our other loan products, where on one page we attempt to make very clear in plain English terms the costs of obtaining the loan, the costs of the loan in its early stages, and the potential costs that a consumer could incur over the life of the loan. Now, it's within the context of the bank's larger efforts that I'd like to focus now on how we support the housing recovery overall. We've restructured our home loans business around the core principles of responsible, sustained home ownership. To achieve this, we're focused on, as I said, making credit available and helping customers make informed home purchase and refinance decisions, providing assistance to help customers who, because of job loss or reduction in income, are struggling to make their mortgage payments, and engaging in broader reform efforts that are taking place in Washington and across the industry. Now, first, a little bit more about our commitment to making credit available and to helping to create successful homeowners. It's important to recognize that the housing crisis hasn't weakened the hopes and part of the American dream of home ownership. Even when you look at lots of people who have had to make the difficult decision to exit a home because they could no longer afford that mortgage payment, they're moving to other single-family homes where they're renting. According to a recent New York Times poll, 9 out of 10 Americans still believe in the dream of home ownership. And our own data suggests that home buyers are much more realistic, given that they still aspire to that dream, about the responsibility of down payment and savings, recognizing that many people who might have thought they were immune from an economic downturn, in fact, have been impacted. Now, our goal is to support that dream. We've made changes to strengthen our home loans business and to lead the industry in a commitment to sustainable home ownership. In practical terms, as I said, that means customers really understand what's required and where they are on that journey to achieve that and to repay over the long term. And it means providing them with very personalized support to help them deal with challenges they may face over the entire length of the loan. As I said, we've innovated with a clarity commitment, and we've issued over 2 million of these since we launched it in April of 2009. Feedback's been tremendous, and the clarity commitment is being used by the CFPB in Washington as a prototype for what they're trying to achieve in the truth in lending statements they're designing as we speak. We've also launched, we believe self-education and awareness is extremely important, and we launched an extensive home loan guide that allows customers to understand every step of the home loan application and funding process. And we've made changes with Bank of America's overall customer strategy to do more business with the customers and institutions we serve. We exited business like lender-placed insurance and like wholesale lending to enable us to focus our resources more and more on direct-to-consumer lending. Next, providing services to and solutions to distressed homeowners has become a very significant part of what we do. As an industry, there have been more than 4 million modifications, changes to the repayment terms on mortgages to enable more homeowners to stay in their homes, and Bank of America has done 910,000 of those, almost one in four. As the housing crisis unfolded, we acquired Countrywide in 2008, and by doing that, provided support to millions of customers who might otherwise have found themselves in a very different situation. And as a result of that, our servicing portfolio increased to 14 million loans or 14 million customers, the largest in the industry. Now, that acquisition also significantly negatively impacted the performance of our portfolio. I really believe Bank of America would have been held out as a role model in the industry had we not done that acquisition because of the commitment we had to sustainable and responsible home lending. We did not do subprime mortgages. We did not do exotic products the way some other competitors and Countrywide in particular did. And today, when you look at our 1.2 million customers who are seriously delinquent in our portfolio of 14 million customers, I'd ask you to remember that most all of those are performing and paying as agreed, but of that 1.2 million, over 81% are former Countrywide customers. So in order to provide customers who have undergone either a total loss of income through a loss of a job or a reduction in hours worked or bonuses paid or overtime they're eligible for, the industry has had to take a massive retooling to build the capability to deliver and meet these needs. When we acquired Countrywide, there were less than 5,000 people in the business working on helping distressed homeowners. Today, we have 35,000. Today, we have a technology platform that enables us to deliver. Today, we offer many more alternatives than we did at that time. So the entire servicing models had to be redesigned. And most recently, we further enhanced our ability to deliver by assigning a case manager or a single point of contact for our borrowers so that start to finish through their delinquency to modification or to liquidation, they're dealing with one person consistently. To supplement our telephone capabilities, we've also built out physical places where for those customers who would prefer to deal face-to-face, they can. And we host events in all of our major markets where we target market our customers who are delinquent and encourage them to come to set an appointment to meet with a representative who ideally can take care of their needs there on the spot. We've got one coming up in addition to many we've done in the Bay Area and South San Francisco in a couple of weeks. And I invite any of you who would really like to understand how our operations work to attend that event. We'd be more than happy to make that information available. So these resources that we've invested are really intended to try to first find an affordable payment for borrowers who had reduced income or increased expenses, and where that can't work, to try to get them as quickly as possible to an acknowledgement and an understanding of what their capability is and get them in a more affordable living expense, which frequently means exiting that home, ideally voluntarily, unfortunately sometimes all too frequently through foreclosure, and to transition into rental housing or other alternatives that are more affordable. As Michael Barr, the former assistant Treasury Secretary, put it, quote, most foreclosures are now caused by economic factors like unemployment rather than by subprime loans. And I don't think any housing-specific answer is likely to make a significant difference right now. The larger macro issues are more important, end quote. We recognize this. We're doing everything we can for our customers who can reasonably afford payments, but we firmly believe we're at a point in the economic recovery where, for those customers where that is not an option, it's best for the rest of the community's recovery to get those properties liquidated and in someone else's hands. Finally, we're engaged, as I said, in the broad efforts to improve the overall housing market and to focus on housing finance reform that must take place with the government-sponsored agencies Fannie and Freddie in conservatorship and with the FHA where it is. I want you to stress that new loan production is of outstanding quality. If you think about what we hold on our balance sheet, which is 100% of all the jumbo loans that Bank of America extends, we've made 17,000 of those loans in the last couple of years, and in that two-and-a-half-year period, only 50 have gone 90 days delinquent. So there are borrowers with capacity to borrow who are willing to invest in housing because the prices are low, the interest rates are low, who have the capacity to pay. It's important to remember that as the housing reform debate occurs, because like many banks have changed their policies to have a higher quality portfolio of loans, we believe that the reforms need to focus on long-term solutions that find a better balance to ensure that credit-worthy borrowers can continue to obtain the financing that they need and the dream of owning a home. There are significant reforms and regulatory changes on the horizon. Some of them will be upon us as we speak. In the Dodd-Frank legislation, there are over 200 changes that will apply to the home loans business alone. Now, our priority is fairly simple: to ensure that credit remains available for responsible customers, that we bring long-term stability to the markets, that we expose more investors to the quality of the current production to ensure that liquidity, other than the government, comes back into the markets through private capital, and that we reduce and never allow the government to get in the position of creating systemic risk to the American taxpayer. One issue that's particularly important right now is the risk retention concept. And this is the desire to ensure that the originator of a loan retains skin in the game of those originations without being able to lay off all of the risk on another partner. And this is extremely well-intentioned and a good concept, but it's important to remember the unintended consequences if that definition of what qualifies as a qualified residential mortgage is too narrow, that could potentially stand in the way of more liquidity coming into the markets, and it could negatively impact a disproportionate share of low to moderate income borrowers. And as I said, given the tighter underwriting standards and the enhanced controls that have been put in place in the wake of the financial crisis across the industry, current origination is achieving high credit quality performance, that the risk retention rules are designed and intended to promote. So reform needs to be balanced and take that into consideration. Now let me conclude, and then I'd be happy to take your questions. The state of the financial services industry, and housing in particular, is not the gloomy one of the Time magazine cover story headline that I shared with you at the beginning, but obviously there's still uncertainty and volatility, as I said, evidenced by today's market performance. While we still have a journey ahead, real progress has been made, as evidenced that Bank of America has helped 910,000 customers with a home loan modification, that we've made $800 billion of home loan credit available to customers, and that we've provided greater transparency than ever before to consumers, voluntarily through our clarity commitment that 2 million customers have experienced, and that will be further enhanced, I'm sure, by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Now, I've spent the last 3 years listening to many, many customers. Customers who are thrilled because they've just been able to achieve their dream of homeownership. Customers who are struggling because they're in a position they never anticipated they would be in relative to loss or interruption of income that stands in their way of meeting their debt. For me and for all of the men and women who work at Bank of America each and every day, these issues are not abstract. They are real. They are deeply personal. We understand that, and we work to make that emotional connection with our customers, sometimes granted more effectively and sometimes less effectively, but our aspiration is to do it each and every time. We truly recognize, because we feel it, because of our broad-based footprint across the United States, the impact that the tragedy of the recession can have on communities that now need to go through the next stage of adjustment. Restoring some of that loss, increasing our commitment to our customers, and helping more customers experience the dream of homeownership at the right point in time for them is what we are committed to doing at Bank of America. It's what we will continue to champion. Customers will continue to trust appropriately the Bank of America brand, and no one should question the commitment of our associates to wherever we can do the right thing for our customers. And you also shouldn't question the efforts of homeowners to find the creative ways that they can to preserve their home, despite the loss or reduction of income that they've experienced. Thank you, and with that, Jed, I'd be happy to take questions.
Barbara, thank you so much. A barrage of questions, as you can see, if you can see me over the stack of cards up here. I will mostly be paraphrasing, but some of you might recognize your exact words being repeated here. I'd like to start with where we are and how we got here. And a question that summarizes what's on many people's minds is this. With hindsight, what could have been done to prevent or at least mitigate the boom and the crash?
It's the question we all ask ourselves. If you look at the confluence of desires, the American dream and the aspiration of home ownership, the change of that from a place where I live to a place where I invest in my portfolio of options, sometimes disproportionately so, sort of unrestricted flow of government money to support that. And finally, because of the price at which the government money came into the market, for private capital to get an adequate return to match that price that the government was able to lend at, corners were cut. Costs were eliminated that in hindsight never should have been eliminated to do a full underwrite of a mortgage. And it's this, it's part of the American situation that we're optimists. So as those prices were going up, we thought they never could come down. And that entered our collective psyche. what could have been done to avoid that. You're not going to change the American psyche, and I think that's a good thing. It's our eternal optimism. It's our ability to get back, pull up our bootstraps and get back into what we're doing that is what makes us very special. But we need to be guided sometimes to ensure that we're being responsible, and there's an important role that the government plays there that I think they failed to play. And there is always the business lesson learned that if it looks too good to be true, it probably is, and you shouldn't pursue it. And I'd say those are all important lessons that will shape us.
One follow-up on that question that someone asked, in effect, to parse that a bit more and respond specifically to some of the claims that the crisis was exacerbated by pressure on Fannie and Freddie to expand their push toward expanding home ownership, and how much of that was really behind the bubble and then the crash?
I think there is a role that government needs to play in making home ownership affordable to those who can afford that sustainable, responsible approach to managing their budgets and their income. And as we started streamlining again, as all this capital, private and government, was in the market, I think the mistake wasn't that commitment, but the way we went about making it happen, which was starting to cut corners in terms of really understanding if that was a responsible decision to make to an individual, by doing the stated income, the no income, no docs kind of products.
And one more hindsight question. Given the recent loss of $8 billion taken on the countrywide portfolio, would you still recommend the acquisition if you were faced with that choice today?
If I were faced with the choice of if I had known going forward what we would write off, no.
Even though... Even though that was asked as a yes or no question, I bet whoever asked that wanted more than a yes or no. Why not?
The cost. We have shareholders. All of us who work here are shareholders. We have many shareholders for whom there are much better uses that we could put our capital than supporting those losses. So,
okay. And a good lesson for question writers, if you're going to ask a yes or no question, you might just get yes or no for an answer.
No, they'll accuse you of having asked it that way.
Exactly. So where we are now, let's talk a bit about what the federal government has done with their loan modification programs. Why have the federal programs, HAMP in particular, helped so few people relative to the huge number of people who are delinquent or underwater?
The HAMP is targeted in a very specific way at borrowers who have a source of income available to make a mortgage payment, and it's an attempt to reduce the interest rate on the loan to match that mortgage payment. And it starts with a level of what is an affordable mortgage, principal, interest, taxes, insurance on a loan. It starts at 31%. And so de facto, when you put that together, you're looking at a subset of the population. When you think of the unemployment numbers and the number of people who are unemployed and do not have a source of income, HAMP was not intended to help those customers. Those are proprietary programs or other investor programs like Fannie's or Freddie's or the FHA that offer, forbearance or deferral of payments to help people get to the other side of unemployment and find a job. And I think if you think about when HAMP was introduced and you look back at what unemployment rates were at that point and what they've become and the length of time that those rates of unemployment have sustained, you're excluding more people. I think in addition, you have investors and you have servicers who sort of know more on the ground by listening to that voice of the customer of what solutions are needed, and so have been more creative in finding alternatives. I think the fact that it's less about the mix of how much hemp and non-hemp and more about the number of modifications, the 4 million, that's most important. Mm-hmm. But I'd say narrow focus, and from when it was instituted to today, a very different economic scenario. They've also made it hard to implement. In a 3-month period of time, there were over 100 changes that Treasury made to the hemp program that servicers had to absorb, and it was physically impossible to absorb that in that period of time, and so there was also operational complexity that didn't need to be a part of it.
Okay. Continuing on the theme of modification programs, no program or settlement will be large enough to help all the borrowers who are having trouble staying in their homes. And even if one were large enough financially, some borrowers really can't afford their homes, even with help. What's the right way to decide who gets modifications and who doesn't?
It is to look at that level of affordability. So if I'm in a house today and, set aside the mortgage payment that I have, what mortgage payment could I make? And if I can't, at any level of interest rates, 2% is sort of a floor, but even if you went below that, if that mortgage payment were still of the borrower's current income, 50, 60%, that's not sustainable. And that's when modification is inappropriate, and that household has to come to the reality that they can't afford a home that large or a home in that neighborhood at that or some other way, and has to make a transition. And that's when ideally a short sale or a deed in lieu or some kind of voluntary servicer and customer solution comes into effect. But if someone's not willing to do that, unfortunately, that's when we have to take the property to foreclosure.
So much of the focus of the response, both from the government and the private sector, has been on individual homes. But there's also the question of neighborhoods, where there's been widespread foreclosure and abandonment. What has Bank of America been doing about those types of neighborhoods, and what should be done?
Yeah, and again, as I mentioned in my remarks, it's a very local story. When you think about California, for example, and I think about back in 2008, some of the newspaper articles that I read about customers who were struggling to stay in their home and were being foreclosed on. And I think the Wall Street Journal in particular did a profile of a neighborhood somewhere in Southern California, and then they came back 2 years later. And that neighborhood, because of the rate at which foreclosure sales were able to happen, prices were impacted, and there were some consumers who chose to stay and had to gulp the fact that their home was worth significantly less than they thought, but those neighborhoods had rejuvenated because new people had come in who bought at a lower price or who rented, and the neighborhood was thriving again. And I think that pace to the other side is what's extremely important. So in a state of Florida or New Jersey, where these foreclosure timelines are as long as they are, I don't think that's necessarily the best path to recovery for some of those communities or for some of those states. But in places like Detroit or Cleveland, where population has shrunk and you've got significant issues of the potential of neighborhood blight because of vacant properties, what we've done is worked with the cities in Chicago and Detroit and Cleveland to agree to raise some of those houses and turn them over to the city so that the mayors of those cities can get on with what their longer-term plan is for rejuvenating those neighborhoods. And I think those are ranges of examples, and everyone is working and talking and trying to be as creative as we can. But the important thing is to assess, Is it a short-term issue that with turnover you can get to the other side of? Or in some of these locations in Detroit, for example, has the population decreased and the situation becomes so severe that raising these homes is appropriate?
Continuing on the present before turning more to the future, there were several questions about the rental side. One of the paradoxes of this recession is that even though home prices have fallen, rents in most places have continued to rise. And in fact, rents have risen most in some of the places where prices have fallen most. There are people who have switched from being owners to renters, but we haven't seen the same shift in the housing stock from home ownership, from owner-occupied stock to rental stock. What can be done to help renters, whether that means encouraging conversion of stock to rental or other strategies?
The investors are 40%, it varies from 30 to 40% in any given month of home sales are cash buyers. And a lot of those cash buyers are investors where they're comparing their 0% return on deposits or money market funds to, I can buy a property at record low prices, fix it up a little bit, rent it, and get a yield on that investment that's significantly greater than some of my other options for liquidity in an investor's mind. So I think there is a lot of that conversion going on. If you look at markets like Phoenix, for example, where you're seeing changes and shift, it's again a very local story, and I think what's going to be interesting is the how fast can you get to that other side, and over time people have concerns about, will a homeowner keep up a house better than an investor with a renter in it, but none of those issues are materializing. And I think the important thing to remember is that this will cycle through economically because, again, most people who are exiting a home through foreclosure or short sale are generally, because of kids in school or commute patterns for work, staying in the same neighborhood, and they're not going to apartment living. They're moving into a smaller single-family home where the rent is affordable. And I think frequently the question is asked, why can't you just convert the existing stock to a rental and allow that person to stay without the transaction costs of having to move? And the answer frequently is they're in too big of a house that even on a rental basis, they could afford. They got in over their heads and they have to downsize as part of the equation. Or there is no level, again, at which an investor in that mortgage would be willing to take the conversion to rental.
Housing inevitably becomes personal, and someone actually offered a bit of a thank you note to you. They just bought a first home, funded 80% by B of A. They're being courted by you to refinance. Thank you so much for the lower rate offer. The question behind this is, first of all, why are rates falling? And the broader question that someone else asked is, what do current conditions mean today for first-time home buyers?
Mm-hmm. The rates are falling because of the flight to quality and the implications of all of that liquidity coming flooding into safe havens and treasuries and secure financial institutions. And the Fed has no interest, obviously, in raising rates given the fragility of the environment at this point. So rates are low, and as I said, our forecast for when rates were going to increase when we did our financial plan for 2011 are now 18 months farther out than we would have planned for in the fall of last year and going out even further. And that bodes well for first-time home buyers or investors or anyone else who thinks the time is right to invest in housing. And for first-time home buyers in particular, the FHA continues to be a viable option with still low down payments. And I'm glad to see they're going back closer to mission by reducing the size of the mortgages that they will lend on. But in addition, I think the reality of the situation of needing to save for a down payment and needing to have a rainy day set of funds in reserve in case there is a disruption to my income or an increase in my expenses because of a medical situation is all the advice that I would give to homeowners, and in particular first-time homeowners. Be planful, be cautious, think about the long term.
You mentioned a
few. And thank you for your business, for whomever wrote that.
Whoever that was. You mentioned a few times how local housing markets are, and you also mentioned that the Bay Area and other parts of California are rebounding faster or at least not declining as much. Why is that?
The pace at which you can move through the cycle of foreclosures. I really believe that. And also aspects of the economy and jobs and desirability of many of the places in California to live. But I do think that there is a correlation between a non-judicial foreclosure state and the rate at which once it's been determined that you've worked to be fair and take everything in consideration for a borrower or a customer, and you realize because of job loss or significant reduction in income, they cannot afford to stay in that home, the faster you can get to the other side and transition them to a place where they can afford it, and the faster someone else, either an investor or homeowner, can get in and take over that property, it's in the best interest of the community at large, as well as both parties. And I think that happens, is happening faster in California. So California, faster to rise, faster to fall because of non-judicial, faster to get to the other side of clearing a lot of the inventory, and I think that's contributing. And it's not a rebound, but it's not declining like many other places still are.
One more question about California before we turn to the future. You mentioned the foreclosure process, which is something that states control. Most everything else about housing policy is at the federal level. But what else can California or other states do for the housing market right now?
Invest in the economy in a way that creates jobs. I mean, whether it's at the state or the federal level, I mean, what's most important is unemployment going down. So allocating investments to places where those jobs can be created is the best advice that I give to either a state or a federal government official.
Okay. Before we dust off the crystal ball, I just want to remind folks who are listening on the radio or the internet that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Barbara DeSore, president of Bank of America Home Loans, who is discussing the future of the housing market. Many questions about the future. So the first type of prediction folks have asked about is what will happen with foreclosures. Recently they've been falling. Is this temporary decline because of what's going on with policy and settlements, or is this a sign of a permanent working out of some of the worst problems of the housing crisis?
I think it's the latter. I'm not to say it's over, but if you think about the pauses that were put in place appropriately so in the fall when it was discovered that there were issues with some of the processes in foreclosure, most everyone has restarted and the inventory is moving through again. And what you're experiencing are the differences at a state level, whether it's a judicial foreclosure state is still very slow versus a non-judicial. So if you think about places in Bank of America's portfolio in a non-judicial state, where as of January there was an accumulation of inventory because of our pause from October through December of doing foreclosures, in those non-judicial states, over 50% of that inventory had been sold by June. In a non-judicial state, 2% had. But so there are more non-judicial states than judicial, so I really believe you're seeing that inventory work through. Remember, the second thing that contributes to ultimately foreclosures are new delinquent customers coming into the pipeline. That rate has slowed. Okay, so I think we're now subject to other economic shocks and unemployment going up, if you've worked through the worst of the inflow and you're working through the sales, there's optimism that we'll get through it. But it'll be a couple more years before it's gotten through totally.
One factor about the inflow that many have been concerned with in the past is the future resetting of arms. How important an issue is that in coming years?
Well, it's been sort of a fortunate thing that interest rates have been so low, so those have reset at even lower rates than many customers were experiencing. And at Bank of America, and I know at some other servicers where we inherited a pay option ARM portfolio from Countrywide, we had been deliberate about trying to proactively reset some of the ARMs or some of the products to prevent people from going through a payment shock. Again, I don't see in the near future, as we work through the recovery of the economy, rates going up anytime soon. So I think the potential of that risk has been mitigated.
In what ways do you think the housing market and housing policy will be permanently changed from the experience of the past few years?
Well, I think at the top, if you talk about macroeconomic factors and you look at the percentage of GDP that housing once played, I think everyone would probably agree it was too high. What we have is a gap of someone declaring what it should be in a target state recovered economy, and I think that's an important policy decision that needs to be made, because then that will inform the mix of housing, the percentage of home ownership, the role that government needs to play in financing for low to moderate income borrowers, and all the spillover effects. And I think that's a missing gap, and understandably so, because we're in the midst still of a very, very slow recovery. But I think that's an important policy decision that needs to be made that will drive many outcomes.
And other ways in which the market or policy will be permanently changed by the past few years?
Yeah, I think the intent of government to support a segment of the population and help create access to housing that was extended far beyond that mission won't happen again. I think the government will go back, if it plays a role at all, to a role that's more narrowly focused on that access of low to moderate income, and I think that's an appropriate role for them to play through someone, an agency like the FHA or HUD. So I think that has changed as well forever.
Okay. Combining a couple of different questions here, maybe not very gracefully, a couple people asked about future swings in the housing market. Essentially, are we entering a period where the booms and busts get bigger? So even if we're sort of in the long run on the same sort of track on average, are we in a world where we're going to expect to see more booms and busts? And if so, does that say something about the financial system, the role of new technology, or something else?
Personally, I certainly hope not, that we've learned some important lessons. Housing.com, I mean, bubbles, right? But again, there's this human nature aspect of what we do and how optimistic we get that we all hope never goes away but needs to be tempered. And therein comes, what's that right balance between the role that government plays in getting to that balance versus the role that private markets play in getting to that balance? And that's an important question that needs to be answered. I'd never say never, but just again, as I listen to our customers, either directly or indirectly, of children who have watched their parents' home be foreclosed on, I think there are important lessons that everyone's learned about, again, sustainability of investments, including the one that will continue to be a major part of all of our financial picture, which is the home in which we live if we choose to be a homeowner. I think that will be approached in a more responsible, sustainable way that will help mitigate the risks of booms and busts again.
And in thinking in other ways about the future of the housing market, what do you expect to see as a result of major demographic changes, such as the baby boom generation retiring?
Retirement's been extended for many members of the baby boom because of investments and cash flows that we're dependent on that are no longer there. And that has implications, right, for those who would take their place and that spill over to the next generation and the next generation. So, again, the rate of recovery of the economy is going to inform a lot of that. And the demographics, again, and across demographics, continue to say home ownership is something special for Americans. And we'll have to see just how fast the recovery comes to say how that demand will resume. And in all the forecasts for the housing market, as I said, you know, $4 trillion to $1 trillion, the Mortgage Bankers Association forecasting, you know, the high $800 to $900 billion market size over the next few years, even given where interest rates are and that sort of thing, it's going to be a smaller part of a recovering economy until we work through all of the inventory. And then the major determinant of demographics and their willingness and ability to purchase a home is going to be income flows.
There are a range of questions of people wanting to ask your opinion about all sorts of things. And so if this were a well-known radio game show, this might be considered like the lightning round where I'm just going to mention, you know, a bunch of third rail issues for you to, you know, give your full reaction to. So the first one is the mortgage interest deduction. What should be done at the federal level about the mortgage interest deduction?
I think that's where it starts at the top with policy. What do you want the role of housing to be in a recovered economy? And that informs all of the different subsidies for housing. And then number two, I think there needs to be a much better and more explicit communication, whatever remains in terms of intentional government subsidies of housing and home ownership, to ensure that the American population is equally aware of all the subsidies that are available for renting. It's part of this transparency and clarity so that they make the best, most informed economic and financial decision for themselves.
So would you be in favor of scaling back the mortgage interest deduction from where it is today?
I think that's a possibility given the role that we want housing to play in a recovered economy, the investment in the proportion of housing that contributes to GDP.
Okay. Now for an actually hard question. Prop 13, one of the factors that probably has more effect on how the housing market looks in California, as well as what underlies pretty much every fiscal question at the state and local level in California. What do you think has been the effect of Prop 13 on the housing market in California, and what should be done about Prop 13?
I should have prepared for this question, but it's not one that I can honestly answer with any level of knowledge, so be pure speculation on my part.
Any speculation?
Yeah, I won't. Okay. I won't. Sorry.
Nope.
Thanks for asking, though.
You bet. You'll get back at me someday for that, I'm sure. Fannie and Freddie, what should happen?
Well, again, you know, what should the role of government be in conservatorship, working to they've constrained underwriting guidelines and criteria to a level where I believe they're getting the level of new credit quality that they'd like to see coming in from lenders who sell to them. They still have a lot of work to do on the portfolio, and they're ultimately the biggest owners of real estate owned in the country. So how they manage through that, and they're trying to be creative with, you know, own-to-rent programs and alternative ways to liquidate that inventory. So they'll continue to play that role while they're in conservatorship. Here in the fall, the loan limits will come down for them, and there's talk that they will continue to come down and that the fees that they charge will continue to come up to try to stop the subsidy of the mortgage product to encourage private capital to come in and be competitive against the cost that it takes to underwrite a mortgage today versus what it did in the past. And I think those are all positive steps. But I think Treasury's been pretty clear. They're not going to do something disruptive given the fragility of the housing market, and they're going to attempt to work over time to reduce the role that the GSEs play in housing finance. And what they have to answer is, what role will the government play? And whatever role they play, they should either be explicitly in for what they define their role to be or explicitly out. But we should not have this fuzzy nature of their commitment that we had that led to some of what we're recovering from today.
How big effect do you think the reduction in the loan limit will have on housing markets in California and elsewhere?
I really don't think it'll have much. The we, for example, our capital levels, our balance sheet will be able to continue to absorb that volume into our jumbo product without any issues. A little bit of price difference, but nothing dramatic. So I think it'll be a non-event.
Okay. One of the long-term issues for California, despite, you know, the current concerns with foreclosures and falling house prices, is how expensive housing is in California and what that means for the affordability of those who want to live here and as a cost of doing business. How much do you think regulations and permitting fees and other supply-side constraints contribute to the cost of housing in California?
It's a good, excellent question. And it's not limited to California. There are other examples. It's more affordable than it's been. That's the upside of what we've been through. But no question, it plays a role. And I'd pull it up that level to just, you know, competitiveness in terms of encouraging job creation and, you know, the spillover effect. Even at high prices, that makes more of it affordable. It still is a beautiful place to live and a very special place to live and work, and all of those advantages will never go away. So demand will be there in ways that will be different in other places. But I think every state has to look at the whole complex of what's been added over time, each individually for a good reason, and step back. And it's hard to do when you're in the middle of a crisis and say, what do we really want to be and what does it take to make the environment better? Now, you know, there's going to be a lot of housing supply because of foreclosures, so it's a few years out, and hopefully over that period of time the economy recovers a little bit more so states can be more thoughtful about that decision. But I think everything should be put in the mix for reconsideration based on that target state of where they want to go over time.
Okay. And then just one last hot-button political issue in the lightning round. What do you expect the impact of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to be on the industry?
I think it will be absolutely felt. As you know, July 21st, the transition took place from some of our other regulators of some of our consumer they took over responsibility for regulating some of the consumer aspects of our business and compliance with some of the consumer laws and regs. As I said, there's a lot of change that's being anticipated. The first one that they'll be coming out with is the combination of what was the Federal Reserve's Truth in Lending statement with the Housing Urban Development's RESPA statement, the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act statement. And I think the approach that they're taking, I hope, is a model for what they'll do. Lots of engagement with lenders and others in the mortgage business. Lots of engagement with consumer, using consumer marketing techniques to sort of prototype a way to do it and having alternatives up on a website and asking consumers to vote or talk about their changes to them to ensure that what they're trying to accomplish in terms of awareness to the consumer is positive. So I take all of that as positive as a first step, but there is a tremendous amount that's coming their way, and I worry about their capacity to absorb it and sort of stay true to mission as they work through it. But I'm an optimist, so I know we'll figure out a way together.
Okay. And then just one last question. You received many titles and awards for your work in leadership. Many of these included the phrase powerful women. What advice would you give to aspiring women leaders?
The advice I'd give is go for it. And determine what it is in a very thoughtful way. Be true to yourself by doing an honest assessment about what you're passionate about and what you're good at and what you'd like to do more of, and work hard to make the match and not sacrifice ultimately what's really important to you. I've had the advantage of working at a company for, I just celebrated my 34th anniversary with Bank of America on August 1st, and in that context, I can honestly say that the company every step of the way has been a perfect match for my personal values with the corporate values. And I just encourage woman, man, anyone who's starting out or looking for a change in roles to do that test of values and where that's a match, because ultimately that's extremely important. The world needs change agents. There's a lot we need to recover from. There's a lot more we need to do. There's a lot we'll continue to learn. There's more knowledge and information available through technology, as well as consumers being much more outspoken than ever before. And we need smart, committed, bright people in every business to determine how to use where we are today as the platform for becoming better tomorrow. So I'm optimistic about that future, and I really hope that young men and women everywhere are and seize the opportunity, because you can always have an impact, but I think particularly you can have an impact today.
Our thanks to Barbara DeSoor, President of the Bank of America Home Loans. We also thank our audiences here on the radio, on television, and on the Internet. I'm Jed Kolko, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.